now be interviewing Mrs. Brenda Luckett. And if she could just, you could just say your name for the camera and give us your consent to record this.
Okay, my name is Brenda Luckett, and I do give you consent to record this interview.
Just so you know, at the end of this interview, I'll have a consent form for you to sign.
Okay.
Letting us know, a form maybe you do something.
Okay.
So just to start off, where can you tell us where you're from?
I was born here in Clarksdale, Mississippi. Yeah.
Okay. So you grew up here?
I grew up here. I moved away, came back, but I've been here. I lived in Chicago for 3.5 years, and I moved to Moss Point, Mississippi for a couple of years, and I went to college. So those are the only times that I've been away from Clarksdale.
Where did you attend college?
Ole Miss, University of Mississippi.
Okay. And so what was it like growing up here in Clarksdale?
Oh, it was great. It was fun. It was a lot of fun. It was like the I Love Lucy kind of thing. You know, we all had as a matter of fact, I'm in the house where I grew up. I moved back home. And we had neighborhoods where you could leave the doors open and the windows open and everybody visited everybody's house. And it was nice. It was nice. Of course, it was a completely all-black neighborhood. But we lived in houses that were built in the 50s. They built some houses to create a neighborhood for middle-class blacks, so to speak, if there was such a thing as middle class during the time. And all the houses were just alike. Forgot about the intercom. All the houses were just alike. It was a working class neighborhood where everybody did something different to make their house unique. But we all, you know, we were all basically grew up all together. Yeah.
So where did you go to school? Did you go to school around there?
Here. I went here in elementary, and I went to, as I said, I lived in Chicago, so when I was a child, it's going to be going on for a while. when I was about third or fourth grade, my father worked for Illinois Central, and they closed the train station here. They closed up the train here, and so we moved to Chicago, and he worked out of Chicago, so we stayed there for about 3.5 years. Then I came back. In seventh grade.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So was this a segregated school at the time?
Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And what was that like for you?
Well, you know, since I didn't know any different, it was fine. You know, it was fine. Now, I went, we had a Catholic school that was right down the street. And it was segregated, but they had, you know, all of the nuns were white. So that kind of influenced a lot of people within our neighborhood that went to that school, but it was all black students.
Okay.
Yeah, and all white faculty.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So you said you didn't know better then. Now that you know better, how do you think, you know, you would have felt if you had known at the time?
I really couldn't say because I didn't know anything negative about it. Everything was fine with me. I think that we had a good education. Now, I do realize, now that I'm older, that there were things that we lacked. Mm-hmm. And I realized, too, also, like, our books and stuff, they all came from, like, the white schools. We never got new books. All of our books were always, they always had the little thing on the inside where you knew it came from another school. And, but we didn't, you know, we didn't realize that we were lacking anything because we didn't know. So, even knowing now, I think it was fine. Yeah, yeah.
So what was school like back then? Was the system different? You know what I mean? Like, was there?
Well, now when I was here in elementary school. The school across the street was a high school then. Mm-hmm. So as a matter of fact, I think that was the first black. Yeah, it was the first. There was the first and only black high school here in Clarksdale. Before that was built, they had a. You would have to go out to Aggie. You'd have to go out to the county. It, you know, once you finished eighth grade, or you didn't go to high school. Because, and if you didn't have transportation out there, you didn't go to high school, unless you went out there and just stayed. It was like dormitory kind of thing for high school. So that was the first black high school, and naturally being in the elementary school, I just could not wait to get to Higgins because you know, our football field and everything was all right there. So to me, it was normal, it was natural, and it was something that I was waiting to get to. When I came back in seventh grade, they had integrated, and it was no longer a high school. It was a junior high. And so we kind of felt like they took something away from our community. And so we had people that I knew who integrated that first year, and it was like they missed, to them, they felt like they really just missed their senior year because they changed the whole system. Yeah, so I was here like in between, I went in between that time.
So what was your family?
My family, well, my mother, father, and me. I was the only child, I was adopted. When my mother was 40 and my dad was like 38, I was adopted, and I was adopted out of Jackson. My mother was a school teacher, and my father worked for, well, my father started out working for the railroad, cleaning out the train station. That was his job. And he was also a he shined shoes, he worked as a hotel clerk. He did everything. He drove, my mother and father both drove cab to pay for the house. And but he finally, eventually worked himself up to being an engineer for Illinois Central. So, I have known when I was small, my father would, there was a train, well, the city of New Orleans comes through here, came through here during that time. And he could get on the train here in Clarksdale and ride to this section we call Oil Mill Quarters. So what he would do was sell sandwiches on the train to Oil Mill Quarters, and then make sandwiches at Oil Mill Quarters and catch the train coming back and sell sandwiches. And that's how he, you know, made his living, because it was really hard for black men to really get a job that would pay enough. You know, teaching was really it. Either you were a teacher or you worked at the hospital. That's, you know, those were good paying jobs during that time. Okay. Yeah.
So you mentioned that your mother was a school teacher?
Yeah.
Was she a school teacher here or?
Yeah, in Jonestown, Mississippi. It's out in the county. Yeah, she taught there for, well, 40 years.
So did you learn anything from her and her experiences as a school teacher?
Oh, yeah. I learned a lot. I learned, first of all, she always told me never to be a school teacher. Don't do this. And what am I doing? But yeah, that I learned. And she was an English teacher, and so I learned a lot from her about being able to speak correct English and how to write correctly. And her thing always was that if you can master that English, you can master any job you want. And so she was a big proponent of speaking correct English and of reading. And so I learned a lot about how important reading is and how much it could influence your life. She was the NAACP secretary for, I guess, about 30 years under Aaron Henry, who was our president, also my godfather. And my dad was one of his, like, bodyguards, because at one time they bombed his house. And after they bombed his house, then they started, the men in the community started guarding his house every night. And so Dad was one of those who would go and sit in the picture window with a shotgun across his lap to guard his house. So now my mother was not a member of the NAACP openly during that time, because if you were, she would have lost her job. You could not let them know that you were a card-carrying member of the NAACP, or you would lose your job. As a matter of fact, Doc Henry's wife was a teacher, but she got fired because he started the chapter.
So your parents seemed very involved in the civil rights movement.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Did they ever tell you any stories about, you know, segregation or discrimination against them and other people?
Well, now I was born in 59, so I was kind of in the segregation part. I really wasn't exposed a lot, like I said, because Doc Henry and my father and all of our parents, they really kind of kept us away from it as much as possible, you know. But one of my things, one of the first things I can remember is that Clarksdale had the first franchise of the Holiday Inn, because the Holiday Inn was started in Memphis, and the first franchise was here in Clarksdale, and it was right on the highway, and so we would pass it every day, and they had a swimming pool out front. So my thought was, I want to swim in that pool. You know, why can't we stay at this place? And my dad would always tell me, well, no, we just can't stay there. So I figured we couldn't afford it. And then finally one day, I just got mad. I said, I want to go to that swimming pool over there. I want to swim. I want to stay in that place. And dad told me what blacks couldn't stay there. And that was the first time that I ever realized that it was someplace I couldn't go. And we didn't have during that time, we didn't have a public swimming pool. So there was a pool there, and there was a pool over in Oakhurst, which is a white community. But we didn't have one. So finally, when I got older, they did open up a public pool, but only blacks went there. And then when they integrated, they cemented the pool. They made a parking lot out of the pool over in the white community because they also had a swimming pool inside Clarksdale High when Clarksdale High was all white. And they put a floor over it and made it a gym. So to me, I just thought it was so weird that the one thing they didn't want us to do was to swim together. You know, I mean, we could do anything else, I guess, I don't know. But we definitely could not swim together. And I can remember also that my father was always Joe Reed. And my mama was always Edna. But I don't care if they were 4 years old and they were white, they were Mr. Somebody. That's Mr. Joe's child, or that's Mr. So-and-so's child. But my mother was never Mrs., and my father was never Mr. So, and we had separate waiting rooms at doctor's offices. And this, really, to be honest, I think they just kind of closed that building maybe about 8 or 9 years ago. But the McWilliams building had our doctor's office, where you had one end the whites could went in, one end the blacks could went in. And even after integration, in the 80s and 90s, the older blacks still went to the black waiting room. They wouldn't go to the white waiting room. There was really no black or white waiting room after that, but they wouldn't go. They would still constantly go to that side. So I remember those things. I remember the F.W. Woodworth was also, they had a snack counter. And during the time when the college students started sitting in other places, they closed it down. Because they would rather close it down than to integrate. Yeah. As a matter of fact, we have a man who has come back now, and he's redoing Woolworth downtown. And that's one of the things he said he wanted to be sure to put back in was the lunch counter. Because to me, in Clarksdale, the racism was of the, it was like, you know, everybody's his fan. Black people love what they're doing. The white people love what they're doing. But in order to avoid it, they would shut it down. And that's what they did with schools. To keep from integrating, they shut it down. Yeah. So, that's my earliest recollection of those things. That, like I said, I can remember Maggie Evers because he used to come to Doc Henry's house all the time, and I can remember Doc Henry when Maggie was killed. He said it was a toss of a coin. That somebody within the white community told him it was a toss of a coin. They had to decide whether to shoot Medgar or Aaron. And Mega got it. Yeah, so I can remember quite a few things, you know. My father, like I said, he had a lot of jobs, but he had a lot of jobs because he was the type of man who would not continue to let you disrespect him. Therefore, he couldn't stay at a job long, you know. And especially if you disrespected his wife. He didn't, so dad couldn't keep a job too much. Because to him, you know, she deserved as much respect as a white woman did. And if you didn't give it to him, he wasn't the type to fight. He might cuss a little bit, but he wouldn't fight. But he'd just leave. He would not stay there, you know. He'd find other means. And that's what he did. Mm-hmm.
So I'm curious, and so you mentioned that your mother told you never to go into education. So
yeah.
What made you want to become involved?
I didn't. You know, I really believe that teaching is just like sort of like preaching. And if you don't follow what your destiny is, everything else will go wrong. And that's what happened with me. I tried to do everything else. And everything else went wrong. And I got to a point where, okay, well, what I do is I just teach until I can do what I want to do. And I've been doing that now for 26 years. I haven't figured it out. But I started out in kindergarten with one of my classmates was she was mentally retarded. I didn't know it, but they had this thing called a morning sickness pill back in the 50s. And her mom was a nurse, and so she took the morning sickness pill, and she ended up being mentally retarded. And I would sit with her in the swing, and I'd always talk to Carol and play with Carol, and I would tell my mom, I said, Carol, she's not like us, but I like her. And I was the one that always protected her. And so my mother finally found out that what it was that Carol was retarded. And I've always wanted to work with mentally handicapped children since then. And so when I was like 7th or 8th grade over at Higgins Junior High, they had the retardation center right around the corner. So I would leave there and go over there in the evenings and volunteer. And that's how I got into working with special education. My degree was in speech and hearing, but I got my master's in special ed. Yeah, so that's what I've been doing ever since.
It's interesting because I've heard that a lot of cases of special education are misdiagnosed.
Yeah.
So how do you feel about that?
Well, they are, and now in as far as trying to teach special education within the public school realm, see, when I first got into it, they had centers, and they didn't come to public school. Then after I think it's the idea of Fannie Mae, Sallie Mae, it was a Sallie Mae decision where all kids had to be educated within the public school system. Then that's when you start coming up with misdiagnosing, because they have to decide according to the funding. And, you know, they kind of try to fit them into a box that would create the largest amount of funding. So that's why you end up with a lot of misdiagnosing, because they really just want to categorize them. They want to box them in. Yeah. For money.
Wow.
Yeah.
So what was your path towards becoming a teacher? I know that you said you tried everything else.
Well, I was when I was in college, I worked in a library. I loved it. So I have 21 hours of library science. And I worked in the grill, and I was a prison guard. And then I came to public school, yeah.
Okay. What were your degrees in again?
Speech and hearing, they call it communicative disorders.
Okay.
Yeah, and I have a minor in library science, a minor in sociology.
Okay. I know you attended this school specifically, so
yeah.
How do you think the education system has improved? Has it improved? What changes have you seen?
Well, I'll tell you not, from a special education point of view, it's kind of shaky. Because when I was in school, those that were slow, they were all in it. We were all in the same room. You know, there was no going out here for this and going out here for that. And teachers had to teach whatever you got. And a lot of times you got kids who never went to Head Start or who didn't go to kindergarten and who started out first grade not knowing anything. And now they are trying to get us to do that again, and teachers are resisting it. And I don't understand that, because you got to teach wherever the child is. But you had a conglomeration of children with all kind of handicaps and all kind of disabilities, and some of them that were super, super bright, and you had to work with them. But we've been kind of spoiled with the pullouts, you know. Well, okay, he doesn't speak well, so he goes to speech. He doesn't read, so he goes to reading. He doesn't read here, so he goes to here. And you got so many pullouts that you don't come back together and really educate the whole child. So I see it as being different. It is a lot different. I don't know if it's better or worse. It's just different. And it might be because, you know, our society is different, of course. But now, when I was here, I went to first grade at the Catholic school, and then I came to second, but I had a double promotion, and I went to third. And see, now, you know, they wouldn't do that now. They wouldn't do that at all now. But that's what they were doing then. They would let you go as far as you could go. Right now, we are limited by a whole bunch of testing and a whole bunch of No Child Left Behind kind of junk, so that you end up teaching the test and not teaching the child. Yeah, so.
So speaking about the NCLB, mm-hmm. What role do you think the government has played in students' education since 2000?
I think they have interfered and not helped. I think they need to come into the system. They need to come here. They need to be required to visit a school and visit for a while, not just come in one day and eat lunch, but go from class to class and talk to the children and talk to parents and find out what it is they need to do. They don't need to pass the laws in Washington or in Jackson, but they need to go into the school system. And once they did that, I mean, once they do that, they would see how much they are hampering our children. Because, see, we have children who come here. I was just telling one of my teachers that I figured out why we have behavior problems in our school. The behavior problems are from children who have common sense. You know what I'm saying? They have common sense. They can think. And those children that can think, they become behavior problems because you're teaching me this test. I mean, what's the purpose? Why am I doing this? This is not important to me, you know, and you're not teaching me. You're not helping me gain knowledge. You're not showing me how to get knowledge, but you're teaching me to test. And so then they, in turn, become behavior problems because they're not interested in that, you know. So I really think that they have been a hindrance. Our government has really been a hindrance as more so than a help. And, you know, they'll say, well, we had teachers on the committee. Nah. But when was the last time they were in the classroom, you know? A lot of times you have folks, I was a teacher, you know, I taught 2 years, and then that was 20 years ago. And now I'm on this committee because I was a teacher. But they need to come, and they need to see, you know, what's going on and how they can help. Okay. Yeah.
Speaking about special needs, was there any, during segregation, was there any sort of, any special attention paid to
special needs children?
Special needs children?
No, excuse me. No, we didn't, they didn't even go to school. They stayed at home.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, depending on the severity of the handicap. I had a classmate that had polio, had a couple of them with polio. They came because they had the braces and they could come to school. But those that were mentally retarded or physically handicapped, seriously physically handicapped, no. They didn't come. They stayed at home.
Okay. Mm-hmm. How do you feel like African American history is taught in your school or in any school system in general here in Mississippi?
It's taught in February. That's it. That's it. You know, it's like, okay, well, it's February and we got to teach it because it's Black History Month. Oh, okay, that's all. It's sad to say, but that's the way they do. I had a lady to ask me, a teacher here at this school, to ask me, was George H. Oliver black? And his picture is out there over the, you know, when you first walk in. I said, Yeah, you know. So, I mean, it is so much less than it was before we had the opportunity to do it. Yeah, I guess now they figure, well, are they, you know, they see it everywhere, they know it, but they're not learning it. They're not learning it because it's not being taught, except in February. And in February, then everybody comes to me and goes, "Miss Lucky, let me get some of your African American stuff to teach my children." And that's it. Yeah.
Do you think that's hindering the younger generation?
Definitely, yeah, because they're not, you know, they don't even recognize or can't even associate the idea of greatness with their race. They really can't. When you do teach it in February, you can see, I mean, they just light up. They're like, they was black, for real. I ain't know that, you know. I had one student tell me one time that I put up a picture of Martin Luther King, and he said, "Who was that?" I said, "That's Martin Luther King." I said, "Yes, it is." She was a woman. I said, "Huh?" He said, Martha Luther King? Martha? No, son. So, you know, you don't really know how they're receiving stuff unless you talk to them and you teach them. So, yeah, it would help. I really believe it would help, especially our boys. I think it would help because right now their greatness is attached to rap singers and sports figures, which is fine. But, you know, it's doubtful that you'll be either. So, you know, we need to talk about people who are inventing stuff and who are building things that you could do, you know, or people who have progressed without the musical or the athletic ability. So, yeah, we really need to do it always, you know, year-round, not just in February, yeah.
So, Aaron Henry, you said he's your godfather.
Yeah.
How has he influenced you and your views on...
Well, now I'm gonna tell you, Doc was the type of person who he was just a fighter, he was a scrapper, and he in the 50s when they first integrated the armed service, they did a little special trial test of integration in the armed service, and he was in it, in the army, and he always remembered that little trial that went wonderfully, but he was also a pharmacist. When he got out of the armed service, he was a pharmacist. So he always had the ability to take care of himself. And so that's why he was looked up to, because there were, you know, he ran a small business downtown. And as I said, he didn't have to worry about white people taking away from his income because he could take care of himself. And so therefore, he was always never afraid to speak out. He spoke out when a lot of people wouldn't, because he had that base. And he would say anything, you know what I mean, whatever came to his mind, and even if you knew what he was saying was true, people would be like, "Nah, Aaron, you shouldn't have said that," you know, but he would do that. And so he influenced me in the sense that if I see something wrong, I'm going to say something about it. You know, I might not be able to correct it, but I will try to take it to the people that can. And also, I won't be afraid to do it, and I won't be afraid to do it by myself, because a lot of times he did have to stand by himself. And he also believed a lot in working with white people, as opposed to, see, people figure, and I don't know why, but people always figure if you're pro-black, then you're anti-white. And he wasn't like that. His thing was that, you know, we could integrate. We could integrate successfully, because he grew up on a farm with black and white, and they didn't realize that they were different until they got on the school bus. Until the whites got on the school bus and he had to walk to school. That's when he realized there was a difference. So you know, the things around you, the situations and the systems around you affect how you interact with people, not just coming from the heart. So his thing, I mean, it was nothing for him to jump up and hug and kiss a true segregationist. And everybody knew it. They were like, "You kiss that man?" He's like, "Oh, I just want to shock him." You know, I mean, he did that shock stuff. That, I mean, and he would jump up and say, "John Stennis is my best friend." And we know he couldn't stand him, you know. But that was just the way he dealt. And he ended up being in, he did become a state legislator. And before he passed, he was in the state legislature. He lost his seat. But, you know, it was at a time when he had gotten older, and he was at a point where he could do what he wanted to do, and it wasn't always politically correct. So someone else came along and took a seat, but it wasn't racial. It was time to pass the torch. So he taught me that you need to know when to step down. You need to know when to pass it on to someone else, because he didn't do that. All the knowledge and all the connections that he had, once he had a stroke, they were just lost. And he had a lot of them. When he died, he had this big phone book that was, it looked like a Bible. And I went through his phone book, and I was with his daughter, just trying to call different people. And we turned in on the C's, it had Bill, and then it had Hillary. And we was like, "Nah." I said, call it, you know, we were just playing around, because we didn't believe it. We called, and we get the White House desk. And then I threw the phone, you know, "Look." So she talked, and she said, "Well, I was just calling. I got this number from Aaron Henry, and I was calling." And the lady said, "Oh, yes, we heard that Dr. Henry passed, and Bill will be calling his daughter, so-and-so." And we were like, "Oh, my God, he really did know these people." So, I mean, he knew people, and he had connections all across the country. And because he didn't get somebody as a mentor and, you know, can't pass it on, that was his loss. So he taught me that I definitely, now I have a daughter, I try to pass things on to her, but I also have other people around me that I always try to pass that knowledge that I have on to them and not take it with me, because that means you got to start all over. So yeah, he taught me a lot now. Now he was dogmatic, especially after Mega died. After Mega died, it was like he became driven. And it was, I mean, he'd call you at 2 o'clock in the morning. "Doc Henry, what do you want?" "Well, I was writing these letters and I needed you to come." I said, "Man, it's 2 o'clock in the morning." "Oh, you're not ready for freedom. You're not ready for freedom. Bye." Hang up, you know. Man. But he had this huge picture of Mega in his house, and I think that every day that was his thing. That I'm gonna do what Mega couldn't do. You know. And now Mega Evers' wife, Merle, he could call her at any time for anything, and she'd be right there. She'd be right there. So I think that was his driving force. He was on like the commission for the Martin Luther King holiday, and he was in the Electoral College. He's the only person I ever knew that was in the Electoral College, was him. So he ended up being in a lot of places, and I just kind of learned by being around him, because like I said, he didn't pass anything on. Half the time, you really never knew how he was thinking. So I want to be able to, whatever I know, pass it on and not take it with me.
So, you know, you obviously seem like a very successful, driven woman. But have any opportunities ever been limited to you because of your race? Or have you always felt like you could overcome anything?
Yeah, I've always, because see, I went to Ole Miss in the 70s. and I went there, and so many people told me, you know, you going there with them white folks, they gonna flunk you, and they did, but I stayed, you know. So yeah, but I'm the type of person, if I get it too easy, then I don't appreciate it, you know, and I just lay back and just play around. But if you dare me, I'll do it. If you double dog dare me, I'll do it, you know. So yeah, I've never felt that somebody, you know, kept something from me because I was gonna know. No, and I really hate when black people say that or even feel that way, because I've seen that all you gotta do is step out there and people will help you. But as long as you stay where you are and think, well, no, they ain't gonna let me do this, I don't know, as long as you think down like that, you'll stay down. So no, I never felt that.
So I just was wondering a little bit about the role religion played in the civil rights.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, of course, that the church was the only place they could meet. The church and Mason temples, you know, the Masonic lodges, because those were buildings that blacks owned, or either, you know, sometimes they rented, of course, but. That was really the only place where blacks would really kind come together, and most of the time when they brought anybody of substance from the civil rights movement, they were at the church. They came to the church. Also, during that time, everybody black went to church. You know, I mean, on Sundays there was nothing else to do. You either went to church or you went to the movies, and you couldn't go to the movies if you didn't go to church that morning. So everybody was there, and that was like the center of the community. We had church and the school. That was it. So that ministers especially were looked up to if they brought in people from the civil rights movement, or if they supported, you know, the civil rights movement. And I can remember some ministers in our town that were not too thrilled about doing it, but their congregation let them know that if you're not going to participate in this, we're not going to be here with you, you know, because they kind of shift on them. So yeah, it was religion helped as far as a place to worship and an organization, because like within the Baptist or the Methodist, you have that organization, you know, from the floor up, and you also have it on a statewide level, so that you can disseminate information that nobody else would get. Now Dr. Henry's famous quote is, "The most segregated hour in America is at 11 o'clock on Sundays." So anything that we wanted to get to black people that we didn't want white people to know about, you could do it at church, because they were going to be there. I can't remember. I was talking to somebody the other day about integrated churches. There's a church over in Oakhurst, what is called Oakhurst Baptist, as a matter of fact, that was one of the first to integrate. And they are completely integrated. I mean, you know, and I was telling this friend of mine who moved back to Clarksdale. He said, "For real?" I said, "For real." I mean, he said, "You mean they don't look at you funny?" No, they don't. No, I mean, and you can feel. My mother would always say that black people had inner antenna, and we could feel whether you're for real or not, and you can really feel at their church that there's no racism there. You know, everybody there is really working together and trying to help each other. But that's the only church in town that I know where that's so, and this is 2000, you know. Yeah, but back then, there was no such thing as going to a white church or going near a white church. They wouldn't allow it.
Mm-hmm. Gospel music, what role did that play in the civil rights movement?
Mm. I don't know. Look, I know the freedom songs and stuff all came from the gospel. Okay, from gospel. When I was, seventh, eighth grade maybe, there was a boycott of the city schools. Because the kids over at Clarksdale High, the blacks at Clarksdale High wanted a Black History program, and they wouldn't allow them to have one. So they marched out of school, and out on the lawn, they started having their own program. They called the police on them. The police brought the dogs and took them all to jail. And so then we boycotted the schools. And that was the first boycott I was a part of. I was young during the time, but blacks didn't go to school for like about 2 weeks. We boycotted and protested. during that time, they would meet every day. After that day, we'd meet at this place called Neighborhood Center. And they'd sing. You know, they always have like a singing service before, kind of getting you excited. And that's when I met Fannie Lou Hamer, because Doc Henry had her to come. And she came and she sang, and people would just come from everywhere just to hear her sing. And she sang like most of the older women that I knew in Clarksdale and out in the country, in the old country churches would sing. She sung without music, and she just belted, you know. So they used gospel music to excite and to unite too, because like I said, a lot of people only came for the singing section, you know. Well, you know, they're going to be singing for about an hour, and they would come, and different churches would have different choirs to come. So I guess it was just for inspiration and for bringing people together under a common goal, because they love singing. They, you know, people, a lot of people would only come out for that purpose. Yeah.
Okay. So going back to your time at Ole Miss, what was that like? How old were you when you went first?
I was 17 when I went to Ole Miss.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And how was that experience for you?
It was fun. I went during the summer. I went to the second summer session. And so that was that. I went during that time because everything was kind of smaller, you know. I could kind of cope a little, and most of the people that I met, I mean that I knew, were blacks that were over there, and that was maybe about 15 or 20 in the whole dorm. But at least I knew them, so I could, you know, work with them. I saw prejudice in my first class, the first speech and language class I took. My professor told me, and another girl that was in there with me, that this was a white man's field, and if we planned to get a degree in communicative disorders, then we'd have to be twice as good and work twice as hard. And the girl that was with me was offended. I wasn't, because my mom had always told me that, you know, when you're going to do something, if you're up against somebody white, you got to be twice as good. You got to work twice as hard. That was just something that we were taught. And so I didn't even see that as prejudice. And you know, to be honest, racism isn't racism unless you recognize it and acknowledge it. You know what I'm saying? I didn't acknowledge it. So I did, however, end up having, we had to end up, about eight blacks, we had to end up almost suing the university to get our degree. Because they were racist. Some of the instructors, you know, would only go so far with us. Or one class I took five times. I got to a point where we would sit, it was five of us, five blacks. It was development, language development. And we would sit in that class, and we would all sit in one row, and I'd tell her, this is a nigger row. You know, I mean, it was a joke after a while. How can I flunk a class that many times? And she was the wife of the dean of liberal arts, so you couldn't go to the dean and complain, because that was her husband. And so we had a hard time with her. And finally, what she told me was that when I finally got a D out of the class, that she did that not because I was black, but because I stuttered. And so if I had a stuttering problem, I couldn't possibly be able to help other people that stuttered. But that didn't explain the other five blacks, the other four blacks that fell with me that many times. Now, some of them just stopped. They changed their majors, or they dropped out. But yeah, so there were instances where I knew that you did this because I was black, but I wouldn't allow that to define me, you know. So after the third time I took it, I did pack my stuff. I called my mom and told her, I'm coming home. And she said, well, okay, baby, you come on home. You don't have to take that. And, you know, one of my friends told me, she said, now, I know you're not going to let her make you leave. Yeah, you're right. You know, you're right. Now, if I leave, I'm going to leave on my own terms. I'm not going to leave because you are bothering me. I'm going to leave because I have done all I can do, and I can't do anymore. So I ended up with a D, but once they averaged my grades together, you know, I had to have a B in order to graduate, so... I was telling my daughter, I graduated on academic probation. So I mean, I was on academic probation every semester. I said so, but nobody ever looks at my transcript. They look at my degree. So, and that's all they want you to do is get through, you know. And now she, because she's over there now, And she's having a hard time, but it's not racial, it's financial. But like I told her, she said, I'm not going. I said, but you can get academic probation and just keep her going. Just keep her going. So I that was the only one of the few times that I kind of felt like I knew that she did it because I was black, but I just didn't give her that satisfaction. But we did have to sue because we had some children, we had some blacks also that were working on their masters that she really gave a hard time to. So we just did like a class action kind of thing. And that was part of the Ayers case too. They put it in with the Ayers case because the same attorney, Alvin Chambliss, was working both of them. And that we were blacks in a predominantly white university who were not receiving the kind of education that we should get. Yeah, but I think that's really about the only time, because most of the professors and the students, they're wonderful. They were wonderful. They helped any way they could. And as a matter of fact, the financial aid, the dean of financial aid, the guy over the financial aid office, his name was Sidney Tate. And I would be in there so much, because you're not supposed to get financial aid if you're on academic probation or dismissal. But I told him, I can't come out of here without some money. My mama teaches school, and I ain't got no money, you know. So we got to be on a first name basis. They said that he lost his job because he gave me too much money. But he was a nice, what was he, an Episcopalian minister. And I told him, I said, how you gonna be a preacher and send me out here into this world with no money? I got to have some money. And I just worried him till he would help me. So a lot of them were very helpful. And some of them now, as a matter of fact, one of the dean of students, I called him not long ago to help my daughter, because my daughter's the type of person, she's not going to say anything. And she's like, Mama, I don't know what I'm doing. I said, well, ask Sparky. Who is Sparky? I said, Sparky Reardon, isn't he over there? Oh, yeah, but does he know you? Yes, yes. So I called him. And he said, take your daughter to come in here and let me know who she is. So, and he's a white guy whose father used to own a radio station here in Clarksdale. And so they have always been helpful. But I really think it's a matter of allowing them to be helpful. See, sometimes you come with the wrong attitude and you get what you expect. But I've always expected them to help me. You know, so that's the way I go. Yeah. So I didn't have a problem. We had, you know, there was a few times when, because during that time, the rebel flag was rampant. And they would wave rebel flags at you and you know, try to intimidate black students, but it didn't bother me. It didn't bother, because I knew what I was there for, you know, so, yeah.
Can you explain what the rebel flags were?
What do you mean? Well, see, Ole Miss, they used those flags like, that was like the fight flag during football games and stuff. That, and now, eventually, the university abandoned that as a symbol. But it used to be a symbol of Ole Miss because, you know, the Confederate Army and all that. So it used to be a symbol, along with Dixie. Dixie is the fight song. And I have friends that were in the band, blacks that were in the band, that refused to play Dixie. But I told them, a black man wrote Dixie, you know? The white people didn't know that, but a black man wrote Dixie. He wished he was in the land of cotton. I said, so you can go ahead and play it, but they had taken it and used it against us so much that a lot of people right now can, a lot of blacks right now can't stand Dixie. My daughter plays in the band, and she's like, Mama, I'm getting $1,200 to play Dixie. I'm going to toot Dixie all over this field, you know. But a lot of blacks don't, you know. They don't see it that way either. But yeah, the rebel flag and Dixie, that is Ole Miss. That's why it was so hard to integrate Ole Miss, because they felt that, you know, the Confederate way of life, they were like Granny on the Beverly Hillbillies. They still think the war is going on. And the Confederate way of life is the only way. And yeah.
So the Confederate flag is actually on the Mississippi State flag?
Yeah, it's in the square.
Yeah, so how do you feel about the flag? It's sort of a controversial.
Yeah, it is. And I understand. I understand that there are people, as I said, they use that, even the Klan used it as a symbol. See, that's where it is. But now I think about, you know, if I got a dish rag and I wash dishes with it, and then you take it and wash your shoes with it, I can still put it in the washing and clean. It's still a rag. You see what I'm saying? So it really depends on how you take it. I don't have a problem with the flag. But now, if you use that flag to beat me with, I have a problem with you, not the flag. You, you know? And so, but white supremacist groups and the Klan have taken that as their symbol. But, I mean, they can do that. It's the same way with the rainbow. Just because I like the rainbow doesn't mean, you know, I just like a rainbow, you know? So it doesn't bother me. It doesn't bother me. But a lot of people are offended because they use that. And they have taken it. But it was always here. To me, it was always here. You can use it for however you want to use it. But I'd be mad with you, not with the symbol. Not with the symbol. And so that's why Ole Miss took it off, because, as I say, it was a symbol. Just like Mississippi State used the cowbells, Ole Miss was the rebel flag. Because we're rebels, you know. It didn't bother me. I was never offended by it. But if the majority of the people are offended by it, if the majority of black people are offended by it, then remove it. And, you know, we voted, and the vote was that they weren't offended. So, it's still there. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So is there anything else that you would like to add?
Mm-hmm. On the whole, what do you think that have been the results of integration? Do you think it's been positive or negative?
Yeah, both. It's been positive in the sense that it was supposed to give us equal footing, and with all the way it started out, we were never really equal, because the whites pulled out of the situation instead of trying to stay in and work it. And it's been negative in that it really destroyed our little bit of, I don't know what you call it, our little community, basically, yeah. Because it pulled us away from our home and took us elsewhere in an effort of integrating with people who did not stay to be integrated with. So now we still have the problem of the majority of schools are black. And the whites went to the academies or moved out into the county area and into one section so that they would all end up going to one particular school, which still separates. It still separates. And so I can't say it's been positive or negative. I don't think it's been. We haven't integrated. We really haven't integrated. We just moved around. You know, we just shuffled. And it's still happening that way now. You know, we have blacks who have moved into Oakhurst, which was a predominantly white section. The whites have moved out into another area, and they've all moved into that same area, and they're all going to one particular school. So we never really integrated. Yeah.
This school, what's the population?
It's 380.
Okay, and mm-hmm. How many of those students are black? How many are?
380.
Are black?
We don't have any white students. None. and it's not about neighborhood schools either, because we have children from all sections of town that come here, but they are all black. We had one, look, dig this, we had one white student. He was a special ed student. He was emotionally disturbed, and he tried to kill his grandma with a golf club. And so they sent him to me. I said, you're going to send an emotionally disturbed white boy to a predominantly, an all-black school, and you want him to be straight. I don't understand. But now I'm just looking, you can work with him. So I worked with him. But it was, to me, I just thought that was just cruel and unusual punishment. You got enough trouble already, you know what I'm saying? But once he got over here, he loved it. He loved it. He was like, well, look, I might even learn how to dance. I said, boy, don't you start that up. But I mean, he really enjoyed it. And so if we really integrated, I think it would be great. But we just, and now it's on, I put it more on us than on whites. We have gotten to the point where we don't, I'm going to go into white folks, nah, you know. We are more racist, I feel, than whites are. I tell people that all the time, and they say, oh, you don't know. You went to Ole Miss, so that's why you think that way. No, I'm serious. We cut ourselves out more than whites cut us out. The whites are not telling us, no, don't come over here, no, don't do this, no, don't do that. But we're not doing it. We are not interested in trying to integrate now. Yeah. But now, what I did with my daughter was, when she was little, anything that went on in the community, I took her to it. And some of her friends go, why your mama taking you all the white folks thing? You know, I want you to see that there's nothing wrong. There's nothing different. They're just like you. They don't have tails and horns, and we don't either. You know, everybody's the same. And so, what, you know, she grew up like that. And then, but she went to schools. She went here to the predominantly black schools. But any outside activity I could get her in that had kids from all over the community, I took her to. And then she was telling one of her friends, Chad, my mama give me up on Saturday morning. I didn't get to rest no Saturday morning because we're going somewhere. We're gonna go over here. We're gonna do this. And she got into the theater where they were. She was in a little play. She was the only black one in the play, and she was a bluebird. She was like, mama, all these white girls, how I get to be a bluebird? But I mean, but I wanted her to see that there's nothing wrong. Everything is right. And now she. She's over there, Ole Miss. She was telling my mama, I think I'm gonna study abroad. I said, do that. I mean, you know, but our children would do that too if they were exposed. If they were exposed to all types of children, they'd be outgoing, they'd be, you know, energetic. But I walked some kids to the fire station, which was about 3 blocks over here, and we were walking through a community, walking down the street. One of the boys told me, white folks must live over here. It's so clean and quiet. And these are black. No, baby, these are black folks. Why so clean and quiet? I said, because they at work. People go to work. So see, they are only thinking about where they live. And nobody at their house went to work. And everything is, you know, trashy. We got to get our children out of that mode. But they can't get out of it if they don't see anything else. If all they see is what they see, then that's what they believe. And it's getting less, the opportunities to get outside are less and less because the money is short. We can't do field trips, you know, and we don't even have cable. I mean, I'm just really upset about that. But we need to at least have cable so that we can control what they watch and let them see other things. Because now my kids can see HBO and Showtime and BET, but they don't watch PBS. And when I tape it and show it to them, they're like, "What channel is? Come on, man! Look, I like this show, you know." So if we expose them, that's all they need is exposure because they soak it. They just soak it in. They just soak it in. So, yeah, if we ever really integrate, it's going to be wonderful. Yeah, I don't know if y'all noticed, but it was like eyes all on y'all because somebody white come into the school and, look, we're walking down the hall with a white man. That's because they don't see. They don't see. They don't see and they don't know. So, I think all we need to do is to be able to expose our children to other cultures. Now, we're going to have magnet school start next year, and I'm so excited. I'm so excited about it. Although I know it'll be a long time before we get some whites in it, but this is going to be the performing arts school. So that gives them an opportunity for them to come. Yeah, so our superintendent, we got a new superintendent, and he's really trying to, you know, integrate it and you know, teach to their strengths. So we're going to have like math and science schools, and we're going to have a language school, which I'm just thrilled. So, you know, if we can really get this off the ground, and we got a lot of Teach to America?
Teach for America.
Yeah, Teach for America teachers that are going to come in and help us do that. So I see good things if we follow through.
If you're in the building, please come to the office. Mm-hmm.
Are you proud of where your race is today, where your people have come to be? After such a long fight and struggle for freedom, and you're not proud?
No. You mean on a personal level, on
yeah.
a local level?
On a personal level.
No, because I know what we could do, and I see what we are doing. To me, I feel like we're going backwards. You know, we are like, say for instance, of course, Obama. You know, Obama's on my man. I got Obama on the man. Obama. But for me, what's happening, or with the people that I talk to here, they just voted for him because he's black. Because I didn't want to see a black man in the White House. But what are the ramifications of that? You know, we have done that here in this city. We have black public officials who have done nothing but just been there because they're black and they haven't helped us. So I don't see us. I would have thought that we would be intellectually further ahead. And mostly what we are is just materially. You know, we have more than we've ever had in our lives. But we don't know what to do with it. You know, we don't. We have more money than we ever had. We have more opportunities than we ever had, but we don't know how to use them. because we have not been educated. You know, it was like we said, it's like just giving a child a whole bunch of toys and not showing them what to do with it and go, huh? You know what they play with? The box. You know what I'm saying? Well, I have a ball with this box. You got all this other stuff over here. Yeah. So we haven't been, I'm not proud of where we are as opposed to where we could be. And where I thought we should be by now. I've been shocked. And that's because I'm living, I went through high school with my daughter, and I'm thinking about when I went through high school. Now, when I went through high school, we had a white counselor and a black counselor. You know, we had white principal, a black sister. You know, everything was trying to be balanced. But I had people that helped me. Now I have everybody that's black, and nobody's helping. You know, nobody's helping. It's like, I don't have to hold you accountable because you're black. You know, I don't have to help you because, you know, I knew your cousin who used to go with my cousin, and nobody's helping. Nobody's helping now. So I kind of think that when we had it where they tried to balance it out, at least we had somebody watching each other, and then therefore they were helping the children. So no, I don't see that we are where we ought to be. Yeah, I don't see it. Sad to say, but I think it's getting better though. It's gonna get better. Yeah. We're not hopeless. Yeah.
So how do you feel about Obama's education reform and sort of what he's aiming to do?
Well, you know, I'm going to be honest with you. If you ran for president and got rid of No Child Left Behind, I'd vote for you. I just need somebody to come. I just need somebody. Yeah. But, yeah, from what I've seen, as I said, anybody, we really need to have. And I love No Child Left Behind in the sense that it makes teachers accountable. You got to teach them. But at the same time, I gotta have funds. I got to have time to implement it, and I got to not just let that be the central part of education. I need to be able to teach. I need to be able to have some common knowledge going on. And so, yeah, I like what he says. I like what he says. I do about education. I do. Yeah.
So, is there anything else you'd like to add? Anything that we didn't ask you?
I don't know. I think I talked enough.
Well, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. Thank you.
Like I said, we have a consent form for you.
And okay.
That's the MLSU.
Okay.
Thank you. You're just going to get a loud laugh.